My sermon today is actually an auction sermon that Kathy Gorski purchased from me, and she gave me the assignment, and then she involved herself in choosing the readings and the hymns, and so this is a joint effort. And I have entitled this, she wanted me to talk about the common good and the Catholic social teachings. That's the crux of it. And then I was left to my own devices beyond that. I entitled this talk, The Uncommon Common Good. I thought when I was given this assignment of talking about the common good and looking specifically to the social teachings of the Catholic Church, which has as one of its basic tenets the common good, that this would be an interesting topic to discuss, yes, of course, but also a no-brainer in reality. Who can dispute the common good? I also thought, as you will note from the write-up I had to give the Order of Service a month ago, that I would be talking about how to stand alongside of the Catholics in this core premise they have. For, of course, it's our core premise too, isn't it? But it seems as though what should be common among us is actually uncommon. What is the common good? I will read to you a definition. The common good is a term that can refer to several different concepts. In the popular meaning, the common good describes a specific good that is shared and beneficial for all or most members of a given community. This is also how the common good is broadly defined in philosophy, ethics, and political science. However, there is no strict definition of the common good for each situation. The good that is common between person A and person B may not be the same as between person A and person C. Thus, the common good can often change, although there are some things such as the basic requirements for staying alive, food, water, shelter, that are always good for all people. The common good is often regarded as a utilitarian ideal, thus representing the greatest possible good for the greatest possible number of individuals. In the best case scenario, the greatest possible number of individuals would mean all sentient beings. This definition of the common good presents it as a quality which is convertible or reducible to the sum total of all the private interests of the individual members of a society and interchangeable with them. Another definition of the common good as the quintessential goal of the state requires an admission of an individual's basic right in society, the right of everyone to the opportunity to freely shape his life by responsible action in pursuit of virtue and in accordance with the moral law. The common good, then, is the sum total of the conditions of social life which enable people the more easily and straightforwardly to do so. The object of state sovereignty is the free choice of means for creating these conditions. There is a distinction between the good that is actively creating a better world and the just, which creates a fair, liberal social infrastructure that allows the pursuit of virtue but does not prescribe what the common good actually is. It lays the foundation. Some assert that promoting the common good is the goal of democracy and socialism. And then there is a definition of the common good from the Catholic social teachings, and this I derive from actually a Catholic site called Catholics for the Common Good. Some people look at Catholic doctrine as a set of rules that Catholics are obliged to follow. As Pope Benedict has explained, Christianity is actually an experience of Christ's love, not a set of do's and don'ts. The social teachings of the Church are a body of beautiful and profound writings of recent popes and bishops that deal with the nature of God and the nature of man made in his image as social beings. Through these teachings, which are geared to our time and culture, we learn through reason what God's plan is for us as men and women and brothers and sisters to each other. This in a most compelling way, leads only to the Holy Trinity and to the path leading to true love and to true freedom. The social teachings include a set of principles that help people inform their consciences and understand their roles and obligations in modern society, particularly in seeking solutions to social, political, and economic situations related to human dignity. Often called the best-kept secret of the Catholic Church, many Catholics are unaware of social teachings. They have not been very accessible to the Catholic laity and are seldom discussed from the pulpit. People who have been introduced to the social teachings find they open up a deeper understanding of the Catholic faith. And then this article goes on just briefly to say, you cannot be in proper relationship with God without being respectful to the dignity of each person whom God loves infinitely. The secret to understanding the principle of the common good is to think of common as applying to every and therefore to each person without exception, and good as that which contributes to human flourishing. And now you can see how this principle is the foundation of human rights. This principle establishes the family as the first cell of society, the first church and the first school of love, peace, and justice. All structures in society must be judged in how well they support the family. Solidarity is more than charity. It is the application of treating the other as another self. It is looking at another and not turning away, but taking an interest in the origin of his or her condition. Well, this all sounded very good to me, nothing I could dispute, something that I had actually grown up with my own friends who were Catholic, and of course, on my own personal journey toward becoming a nun. But then there was a fissure, a recent fissure. And on March 18th, an op-ed columnist from the Washington Post, E.J. Dionne Jr., wrote, "One of the tragedies of the viciously politicized battle over health care reform is the defection of the nation's Roman Catholic bishops from a cause they have championed for decades. Indifferent to political fashions, the bishops were the strongest voices in support of universal health coverage, a position rooted in Catholic social thought that calls for a special solicitude toward the poor. Yet on the make-or-break roll call that will determine the fate of health care reform, bishops urge that the bill be voted down. They are doing so on the basis of a highly tendentious reading of the abortion provisions in the Senate measure. If health reform is defeated, the bishops will have played a major role in its demise. The provisions they dislike were written by two Democratic senators strongly opposed to abortion. Pro-Choice America called their amendment anti-choice, outrageous, and inexplicable. Planned Parenthood and the National Organization of Women were equally critical. But the Nelson Casey language still didn't go far enough for the bishops. This week, and of course this was written in March, Cardinal Francis George of Chicago, president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, claimed the flaws and loopholes in the bill's abortion section are, quote, so fundamental that they vitiate the good that the bill intends to promote, end quote. And as a result, he said, quote, the Catholic bishops regretfully hold that it must be opposed, end quote. And then something extraordinary happened. On Wednesday that week, a group representing 59,000 Catholic nuns, plus more than 50 heads of religious congregations, issued a strong statement urging a life-affirming yes vote in support of the Senate bill. And this is the quote. While it is an imperfect measure, it is a crucial next step in realizing health care for all, the statement said, adding that the bill's support for pregnant women represented the real pro-life stance. We are sisters focused on the needs of people, said Sister Simone Campbell, a spokeswoman for the group. When people are suffering, we respond. Sister Carol Keehan, president of the Catholic Health Association, loyally refuses to criticize the bishops, but argues that their interpretation of the abortion language is simply wrong, and she too released a forceful statement in support of the Senate bill. And this is what she said in part. We looked at the bill. We spent a lot of time with Senators Casey and Nelson, and we agreed to support it because we believe it meets the test of no federal funding for abortion. Perhaps the language is not the way I would write it, but it meets the test. I am not going to take a little bit of abortion in the bill to get federal funding. She added, I cannot walk away from extending coverage to more than 30 million people. Rather astonishingly, the bishop's statement misrepresented the views, whose members include 600 Catholic hospitals and 1,400 nursing homes, the views of the Catholic Health Association. Cardinal George acknowledged that the bishop's analysis of the flaws in the legislation is not completely shared by the leaders of the Catholic Health Association. And then he said, they believe, moreover, that the defects that they do recognize can be corrected after the passage of the final bill. But Sister Carol, as she is known, said the latter assertion was flatly not true. We're not saying that, she said. Her organization believes the bill is written as written guarantees that there will be no federal funding for abortion and does not need to be corrected. Why the bishops would distort the position of the church's major health association is, to be charitable, a mystery. And then one final little article is by Sister Marianne Walsh, who is from the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. She is responding to E.J. Dionne's article. And the title of her blog was, And Then There Were None, N-U-N. As someone who taught in Catholic schools, which Washington Post writer E.J. Dionne attended, I applaud him for knowing Sister is usually right. I can even excuse him for mistakenly accepting as true what a few dozen nuns said in a letter that was sent to Congress by Network, a nun social justice group. Dionne made his case in a March 18th column titled Listen to the Nuns in the Washington Post. However, the signers he listened to were flat out wrong in many instances. For example, they falsely said, we represent 59,000 Catholic sisters in the United States. There were 55 names or groups listed as signers to the letter, with one, Sister Marlene Weisenbach, signing twice. Does she have Chicago roots? Sister Weisenbach leads both the Leadership Conference of Women Religious as well as her own community and signed for both. However, there are 793 groups of sisters in the USA, so there is no way that 54 or 55 signers represent all of the American nuns. There are also religious order procedures to consider. Many of the endorsers signed on as individual teams. That's nun speak for saying they represent only themselves, not their membership. It's a way of keeping all heck from breaking out in the convent, where opposition to abortion is stronger than what Network says or doesn't say, since it won't take a position and avoids the stance. There is also confusion by those who might equate Network with the LCWR, which is the Leadership Conference of Women Religious. Network is a social justice lobby. In no way, shape, or form does it represent 59,000 nuns. Even LCWR, the Organization of Major Superiors of 100 of religious orders, can no longer claim to represent that many, since a percentage of U.S. orders belong to the Council of Major Superiors of Women Religious. E.J. Dionne is a great guy. I know him personally and professionally, and as a good Catholic school fellow, he has reason to trust the teachers who gave him his educational start. They were right when they taught him that 2 + 2 = 4. So when they said 55 translated to 59,000, he believed them. That the nuns also tried to mislead the entire U.S. Congress similarly is an embarrassment, but such may be political warfare where, as is said, the first casualty is truth. The media are having a good time with the nuns versus bishop story, AP has called, CNN wants a Friday afternoon debate, CBS Radio Boston has been on the phone, and Catholics in the pew want to know just what is going on. All because of a letter from a group misrepresenting itself and the facts. Meanwhile, the real problems with the Senate health care reform, unfair treatment of immigrants, and threats to the child in the womb get ignored. After this was written, the nuns, those 54/55, were investigated by the bishop, who felt that they were getting a little bit uppity and perhaps being a little bit too independent. So it's called the quality of life investigation that is now underway. So as much as I would like to stand on the side of Catholic social teachings, and I do on the premise of it, I have a problem standing alongside of this and question what is the common good. Last night, unexpectedly, I watched a movie called The Girl in the Cafe, and oddly enough, it had to do with the C8 conference in Reykjavik, Iceland, in 2005. And here's a quote from one of the main characters, the finance man from the British contingent. Our goal in Britain, what we bring to the table, is the plan to half the poverty that actually kills people, to half the number of children who die, which is shockingly high, to half the mothers who die in childbirth, which is heartbreakingly high, and which few people in the world actually know about. The problem is that it's all going very badly, this conference, because the countries can't agree on how to remedy these things or which ones to attend to first, and the reality is that the first glimmer at something good being done probably won't even be visible for 155 more years. And the greatest tragedy of all is that it can all be remedied if people cared enough about each other. But they don't, you see. People can talk the good talk and do their bit in their communities and even in other countries, but they are Band-Aid fixes, nothing that is enduring. And there's a reason for that. And the reason is that the people making the decisions are too far removed from the circumstances themselves to do absolutely whatever it takes to make things right in people's lives. 8 men in one room could literally save hundreds of millions of lives if only they could all see it as pushing for something as great as the abolishing of slavery. But we are in a time when people are worried about the economy. It's not a good time for unselfishness. And the girl he's speaking to says, that's a pity. I didn't know that unselfishness had a good time and a bad time to it. I had no idea what this movie was going to be about when I rented it. It just sounded interesting, and suddenly there in front of my eyes was the theme for today's sermon, the common good, and how uncommon it is, and how to reach it. And the bottom line is simple as much as it is complicated. What matters are the relationships that develop between people. You can have all the plans, all the rules, all the do's and don'ts, shoulds and shouldn'ts. You can cite the differences between people, be tolerant of them, respectful of them, concerned about them, dumbfounded by them. But unless you actually take time to know people, to take the time to talk and to listen and to stay silent and to hear what they have to say, none of the formulas that they adhere to or that we adhere to matter in the slightest. When we talk about or learn about the important things in life, the media we are given gives us snapshots and sound bites and statistics. We are rarely given full stories with background histories of the suffering and how they got into those situations, or about the history of failure in the social system that keeps the poor poor. We are missing the stories, and those are the bindings we need to have in order to relate, in order to see ourselves in their lives. Without the stories, the realities of life are out there somewhere, and we can nod and cluck our tongues and shake our heads with concerns, and we can reach into our pockets, many of us, and bring out money, and money is certainly needed to right many of the ills and injustices in the world. But we are also not digging deeper as regular citizens and trying to find out how to right these injustices. Well, some are, yes, of course, but we as a religious institution, we're not. We used to have a history of doing so as Unitarian Universalists, but it seems as though we've lost that core calling, which has always been front and center in this religion. But it's gone for the moment, and yet it's still there. Our strong and vibrant history of affecting change when change is needed is there. It's here in this room with us right now. My goal for this congregation is for us to focus on the eradication of poverty in the United States. That's my goal for us, and we must do everything in our power to educate ourselves about how to do this. My contribution, it will be small, but it will be a start, will be to discover how Sweden went from a culture of the haves and the have-nots, from incredible poverty and suffering, to becoming a leading country in the world for what is truly the basic needs of all people, for everybody's inalienable rights. How did that social democracy get created? What were the stumbling blocks? How long did it take? Why is it functioning now? And what are the challenges for it that are there that we can learn from? So that's my goal for the United States. It might be too large of a goal. All right, then. Let's focus on the eradication of poverty in Waukesha County. That seems a bit more manageable. That will be the goal, and none of us should rest until that is done. We will not make grand plans that get in our way. We're going to learn from those who know, and we're going to ask the questions, and we're going to educate ourselves about what's worked and what hasn't, what it stems from, what the history of it has been in this county, and the role we can play in its eradication. We are not a coffee klatch here at LCUUC. We are not a nice group of nice people who have good intentions. We are more than that. We are a religious institution, and as such, we have a responsibility to the good of the whole. What are we if we are not that? We must educate ourselves. Who makes these rules? Who are the players, the decision makers? And how did they get chosen? And what do they know? And who knows more than they do? Who hasn't been talked to yet? Who hasn't been heard? The people living in the poverty, perhaps, that might be a good start. What is a common good that we can rally around? Isn't poverty the number one concern that everyone would have in common? Who could sit by passively knowing that children are living in poverty and dying on the streets or hidden in their homes? Who could turn a blind eye to this needless suffering in this day and age in our own country and in this very county, one of the wealthiest counties in the nation? I haven't been able to attend the recent meetings that Betsy Foss Campbell has apprised our congregation of regarding this issue, but I am committed to doing so my following year with you. If I do nothing else, that is what I'm committing to. And I hope that each and every one of you will also commit yourselves to these educational meetings so that we together can actually do something tangible and relevant and imperative as a religious institution. I would like for this congregation to have the reputation of being a religious institution that walks the walk, that is committed to effecting change where it can, and that it took upon itself to address the myriad layers of poverty affecting the lives of people in this county. And it has been known for that. It is known for that. We need to put a face on poverty in this county, as Chip Duncan put a face on poverty for us in his beautiful film slide in his book, showing the faces of those people in Haiti and Afghanistan, Somalia and India. We have cameras. We can write. We can think. We can do these things. And this congregation has certainly been involved in these matters long before I entered the scene, so please don't think that I'm not aware of that. I am. I know about the Cardboard Village, or Cardboard City Project, and the Community Garden, and the Bread for Life dinners, and the upcoming Heifer Ranch Project, and the project in Appalachia that the high school students will probably be doing next summer. These are tremendously important things that are being done. But I think that we also, and perhaps even more really should focus on the majority, have our focus of our majority of our energies and resources focused on our own backyard. How can we sleep at night if we don't do this? We must put a face on poverty that exists right here in our midst. What you have done as a congregation and continue to do is exemplary, but it is only a small drop, as all of you know, and it is only being done by a small number of us. I have certainly been negligent in this regard. Cannot we determine that the eradication of poverty in this county be our uniting goal, that it be our common ground? Cannot all of us, each and every one of us with our thinking brains and our caring hearts and our myriad life experiences and know-how, cannot we join together and learn and do something in this area? And not something small, but large, to do something to eliminate poverty right here. What we cannot do is lose heart for the things that are the guiding light for us. Poverty and all of its suffering it brings on a daily basis in thousands of lives right here in this county is not out there. It is sitting with us in this room. It is with us right now. Poverty is up here with me at the podium. It's on this stage, front and center. Poverty is walking up and down the aisles, looking at us, sitting down with us, holding our hands and turning our faces toward it to see it in its eyes. It is a face like ours, reminding us that at any moment, any one of us could be leading that life, and some of us already have done, or maybe on the brink of it right now. Poverty doesn't even look like we thought it might. When I was a single parent with three children, I went directly from a middle-class life before my divorce to a life of poverty after my divorce. But do you know what the really frightening bit of that was? It was the day I finally bit the bullet and called social services to see what sort of assistance I could apply for, food stamps and housing assistance and medical care for my children. And what I found out that day was that at $5,000 a year for a family of four, I did not qualify for any aid whatsoever. Because as long as I had an income of any kind and had housing, I was fine. That in order to qualify for help, I needed to be homeless. Thank God for my family that it would never come to the fact that I would be on the streets, my children and I. But what about so many others who are not so fortunate? What about those with drug and alcohol abuse or physical abuse issues that are systemic? What about not having the skills necessary to get or hold any level of job and yet there are mouths to feed? What about the unemployment that is at such a high rate in our country today that people even here in this church are struggling more than you will know, who are finding themselves on the edge of poverty and don't know if there will be a way to stave it off? We are a religious institution, and our Sundays together, while certainly good and important in a myriad ways, are also the time for us to listen to hard things, the real things about life, just outside these doors, and to vow to do something about them. We are a welcoming community. Everyone is welcome here, young and old, atheist and theist, black, white, brown, tall, short, rich, poor, educated or not, Republican, Democrat, articulate and shy. Everyone is welcome here. And out beyond these doors, the work of our hands and of our hearts is waiting for us to do what we can do to alleviate the needless suffering that abounds just around the corner. The church year is nearing its end. The summer days are shortly upon us. The next church year is just around the corner as well. Can we vow together that beginning as soon as today, we will begin the important discussions about how to get our hands around poverty and to see what parts we can play in its ultimate eradication in this county? There are no wheels to reinvent. There is a way for us to learn what can be done and to start to do something about it. And I firmly believe, I believe with all my heart and with every fiber of my being, that together we can do something good in this area. And that something is why we're here at all. That something is why this church exists in the first place. As Margaret Mead wisely said, never doubt that a small group of people can get something done. For indeed, it is the only thing that can. Let us make common what is at the moment uncommon. Let us be the hope we ourselves need in the world. May this little church on the corner of K and E become the actual light we are asking our children to carry, and not a symbol only. Thank you.